prophecy is moving forward at a dizzying pace, and indeed that's the case. It seems like our world is more and more chaotic, or maybe that's just me and the people with whom I associate, meaning mostly customers. It almost seems that our incredible ability to communicate has caused more chaos. You know, I now have the ability to communicate with the phone that is strapped to my belt at least 16, 17 hours a day with anyone from anywhere around the globe. Just as a matter of illustration, I went over to visit my parents earlier this week. My parents, as you all know, are still Amish. Most of you have met them, and my dad had his knee replaced. So I'm sitting in his living room, okay, in an Amish home, and what am I doing? I'm sending emails back and forth to Hong Kong from my telephone. That just kind of illustrates how small the world has become. We're able to do this, and like I said, you know, you have the ability to bounce information all around the globe in an instant, and I think that actually facilitates more confusion than clarity a lot of times. At least that's the way it seems. Of course, you always look back nostalgically to the good old days of fax machines and the postal service and Pony Express. And I remember, actually, this dates me, I guess. I remember when I was working for Chrysler and they bought one of these newfangled machines called a fax machine. We had just gotten one, and I thought this was just wonderful because I was working in engineering, and it enabled me. I was working at that time with a company in Mansfield, Ohio, and also one in New Jersey, and we're designing machinery, and they would call me up and wanted to know if they could do this, can we change that? And then we had this wonderful device. I say, fax me a sketch. So they would fax me a sketch. I walk down the hall, pick up the paper. Oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about. You had, you know, we cut up blueprints so that they would fit through an 8.5 by 11 sheet. And then I taped them together when it came to reconstruct it. And I thought that was wonderful. Of course, now, today, I mean, yesterday we were doing basically the same thing, reviewing a tool, and we had conference in people from New York and Michigan and Florida, and using what is called GoToMeeting, which is a service that costs something like $40 a month. It's unbelievable. And everybody could see everybody's screen, so you're talking on the phone in a conference, and you could see the computer screens so that we could review the tool that was being built. It's just an example of how things have changed, and it should, you would think, improve things, and perhaps it has, but it also facilitates confusion. And I'd like to maybe illustrate some of that. I'll start my sermon by saying that the late news commentator and radio legend Paul Harvey used to say in his deep voice, you know what the news is, and now you know the rest of the story. My question is whether or not you really know the rest of the story any longer. You know, we've got so much news going around the globe and so much misinformation that it is very difficult to know the truth. I'll give you some examples of, you know, what's in the news today. I've got printed out all this information. I'll read excerpts for my introduction. We've got a big debate going on right now with healthcare, do we not? Today is the big day. Isn't it amazing that we can now pass bills on Saturday night? The first bill was passed on a Saturday night, and now we've got the Senate passing the healthcare bill potentially this evening on Saturday night. One is 1,900 pages, the other one is 2,000. And you don't really think about how big that actually is until you see it stacked on, I mean, the stack is about this tall. And that is written, if you've read portions of it, it is written in summary form. it will take another 100,000 or 200,000 pages of regulation in order to actually roll it out in a way, what this actually means. So, health reform, is that necessary? I would have you know it is. And here's why I know that it needs to be reformed. Just in my small company, we have health insurance for our 40-some employees, not all of which are on the program, but it's offered to them. We renew that program every year. This year, we were hit with a 38% increase. Now, tell me of one other thing that has gone up that much in the last 10 years. The business we are in, actually, the cost of tooling, what we can sell tooling for, has declined. So how do you justify that? There's really no justification. I think everybody agrees that healthcare needs to be reformed. The only thing that I can think of that is worse than a 38% increase is for the federal government to run it. So you have this big debate going back and forth, and you have people on one side and people on the other side, and it's all in the news. Okay, here are some excerpts. Reed says the 2,074-page bill would expand health insurance coverage to 30 million more Americans at an estimated cost of $849 billion over 10 years. That's just a measly $849 billion over 10 years. That's $84 billion a year, which, I mean, by today's standards is pocket change. So that sounds pretty good. Proceedings begin at 10 a.m. and will last through the early evening. And he needs 60 votes to overcome the Republican filibuster. So they're going to solve the problem by writing 2,074 pages of legislation. That's just summary form. They can't run the post office. And they can't run Medicare, but they're going to solve this problem, and we know what the result is going to be. Democratic leaders are optimistic of success, but they need every Democrat and both independents to say yes, and two moderates remain uncommitted ahead of the roll call, which is expected around 8 p.m. The vote will determine whether debate can go forward on Majority Leader Harry Reid's 2,074-page bill to dramatically remake U.S. health care system over the next decade. You know that most of this won't go into effect until 2013. You also know that the tax for it is going to start right away. That somehow doesn't surprise you. I was talking to my attorney this week on a different matter, and he mentioned that the reason it's only $849 billion over 10 years is because for the next 3 years they're going to tax us and not provide any benefits. So that actually reduces the yearly cost, because you collect taxes for 3 years and then you're not giving any benefits. And I'm talking in general terms here. So he said what will happen after 10 years, even if their predictions are correct, which they never are, the deficits are going to explode. So that's health care. And, of course, you've got everything being bandied about. Then this week in the news, I read $100 million for one vote. So they've been buying votes, and the way they got one Democratic senator to support it was, a Democratic senator from Louisiana, is they wrote into the bill a provision that will provide an additional $100 million of Medicare support to her district. That's why it took 2,000 pages. You've got all these things embedded into it that will provide benefits to certain areas of the country. Then another thing that's been on the forefront of the news has been climate change. Well, it used to be global warming. Now it's climate change. And there's going to be a meeting over in Copenhagen here in December where this thing, this whole thing is supposed to be brought to a head. Here's a headline from this morning. Coca-Cola leads cheering section for One World Climate Change Taxes. 100 companies pushed 16 days, quote, 16 days left to seal the deal on a $10 trillion treaty. Okay, they have a website that you can sign a petition to become a citizen of what is called Copenhagen. It's a, instead of Copenhagen, it's Copenhagen or Copenhagen, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And you sign a petition to put this thing forward, and they actually have a Copenhagen passport. Okay, you can become a world citizen of this important issue, which it's interesting that it has become so critical to push this through since the world has stopped warming. And then this week, another thing came out. Climate skeptics claim leaked emails are evidence of collusion among scientists. What some hacker did is they hacked into the University of East Angeles climate research unit and downloaded gigabytes of information and dug through emails that went back and forth between scientists, and it's been confirmed that these emails are real. Climate change skeptics who have studied the emails allege that they provide smoking gun evidence that some of the climatologists colluded in manipulating data to support the widely held view that climate change is real and is being largely caused by actions of mankind. Here's an example. In one email dated November 1999, one scientist wrote, quote, "I have just completed Mike's nature trick of adding in the real temperatures to each series of the last 20 years, i.e. from 1981 onwards, and from 1961 for Keith to hide the decline of the temperature." So that was in the news. Then we have from Spiegel Online a headline on climate change. Notice it's climate change now. It's no longer global warming. And it says this, "Global warming appears to have stalled. Climatologists are puzzled as to why the average global temperatures have stopped rising over the last 10 years. Some attribute the trend to a lack of sunspots, while others explain it through ocean currents." And, you know, that's probably true. But notice this. "The planet's temperature curve rose sharply for almost 30 years as global temperatures increased an average of 7/10 of a degree Celsius, or 1.25 degrees Fahrenheit, from the 1970s to the late 1990s. Quote, "At the present, however, the warming is taking a break," confirms meteorologist Moeb Latif of the Leibholz Institute of Marine Sciences in the northern German city of Kiel. Latif, one of Germany's best-known climatologists, says the temperature curve has reached a plateau. "There can be no argument about that," he says. "We have to face the fact that it's not rising." But he also says, and here's a picture of Latif. Latif says, "We have to explain to the public that greenhouse gases will not cause temperatures to keep rising from one record temperature to the next, but that they are still subject to natural fluctuations." So it's still a problem. Then we have had the issue down at Fort Hood in Texas, where 13 soldiers were gunned down and another 30-some were injured by Major Hassan. And now that's being bantered about in the public arena. I mean, I'm just demonstrating that you've got a lot of controversy going on out there, and you know, Mr. Here's from a Mr. Daniel Pipes. "Despite encouraging references to violent Islamists by Senator Joe Lieberman, Democrat, actually he's an independent from Connecticut, chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, there is reason to worry about a whitewash of massacre that took place on November 5th that is just so much easier than facing the implication of a hostile ideology nearly exclusive to Muslims. Here are some of the things that this individual that committed this crime, here are some of the things that he had said. I'm just going to pick some excerpts. His supervisor, Captain Naomi Sermon, recalled his telling her that as an infidel, she would be, quote, ripped to shreds and burn in hell. Another person reports his declaring that infidels should be beheaded and have boiling oil poured down their throats. Hassan also contacted jihadi websites via multiple email addresses and screen names. He traded 18 emails with a Al-Qaeda recruiter, and here he is in the U.S. military, and somehow this all goes unnoticed. So what is my point? My point is simply that the truth is something that we do not see much of in the news media. The truth has become a rare commodity. In fact, if you ask hard questions, in some cases, the news media poo-poos people that do that. And yet we as God's people need to try to discern the truth and remain committed to the truth, because I want to boil this down to one concise statement that Jesus Christ had made in his day in circumstances that weren't that much different. If you'll turn over with me to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. John chapter 8. In verse 32, this is both a powerful statement, and it is something that we need to be committed to, because it is, as it says here, very liberating. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Jesus Christ made that statement. And notice the answer that his people gave him at that time. And I challenge us to think about this, because you could move this forward, particularly in the United States of America, where we deem ourselves to be free. And they answered him and said, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin, and a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." You know, liberty is more than freedom from physical or political oppression. And I believe personally, this is my personal opinion, that we are headed down a path that ultimately will lead to big government and oppression. And the reason that I say that is, if you look at what is being passed in the United States in government, once you pass entitlement programs of the magnitude that we are doing right now, there is really only one way to solve it, and that is through some form of higher taxes. We will see higher taxes because, I mean, you just have to look around at other nations that have attempted the more socialist model. And that is the result. And you could argue that, okay, you know, if we all agree to that, if you want the government to basically care for you from cradle to the grave, it comes with a price tag. And I remember this. Living in and working in Germany, where 50% of your paycheck disappeared, and I was not in a high tax bracket. Now, we did have socialized medicine. We had all of that. You can argue about whether it was good or not. So 50% of your wages disappeared with your paycheck. And then when you went to the store at that time, sales tax was 15%. And there, you know, we talk about, as I recall, the annual license fee for a car was at that time like something like $200. You know, it's just if you actually figure what percentage of the gross domestic product the government controls, it was a huge number. Now, on a positive note, generally speaking, the quality of life was a bit higher, and you had the people that couldn't afford homes, which is over 60% of the people rented, and then you have the very rich that lease or rent the homes to the majority of the population. That's where we're headed, but the taxes become oppressive, and it leads to tyranny. So back to my statement, liberty is more than freedom from physical or political oppression. It is more than a legal right to self-determination. What Jesus Christ is talking about here is truth as we in the church, or as the Bible defines it. The resounding message of the Bible is that true liberty can only come through a knowledge of the truth. And it goes beyond that, actually, because knowledge of the truth is not enough. We need to live it. But it will most assuredly be achieved by an entirely different means than from that which we see in the news media around the world today. The freedom of press is like democracy and free enterprise and so many other things that the world has devised. It is the lesser of evils. You look at freedom of the press and all the audacious things and the untruths that are expressed because, well, we have freedom of the press. And as a dear friend of mine that grew up when I was growing up in New Bedford used to say, you can print anything on paper. You know, the paper will not object to lies. You can print anything. Jesus Christ, the author of our salvation, the true Passover Lamb, the King of Kings, declares, as I said, with indisputable certainty, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Notice how he framed the statement. He did not say that the truth might make you free. He said the truth shall make you free. There's something liberating about being truthful. I emphasize in our organization all the time that if we make mistakes, then at least let us admit it quickly so that we can also very quickly solve the problem. And if you read everything about the healthcare, and you know, if you look at it, you've got two conflicting bills that will somehow have to be reconciled that are in totality nearly 4,000 pages. It is impossible for a single person to know and to comprehend what is contained in there. I mean, you look at the Bible. The Bible is, let me check here, the whole Bible, the history from the beginning to the end in the New King James Version is only 1,393 pages. And there's a benefit to brevity. Let's go over to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. I saw some video clip this week where they had the two bills, and then they had the stimulus bill was about an inch thick. And in one year we've gone to the pile typically is about 12 or 14 inches tall of these bills. And then, I think this was Glenn Beck, actually, that I was watching, and he showed the Constitution. It's just a couple pages. And somehow, the Constitution has served this country well for over 200 years, and they were able to concisely define what the country should be based upon, and it's just a couple of pages. And look at where we've come to. Second Peter, let me see here. Well, 2 Peter was in here this morning. Here we go. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 19. While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption, for by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage. You know, we live in a society that talks about us being free. We actually banter around the conservative versus liberal labels for political parties, and both of them promise liberty, and yet nothing is more corrupt than government. That is a well-established fact. Notice how concisely Peter framed this. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. Look at the preceding verse. For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through licentiousness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error, while they promise them liberty. You know, nothing has changed. It's just gotten worse. We promise liberty, and what we're delivering will lead to tyranny and oppression. The heart and core of what I wish to leave with you today is this. While knowing the truth, as we do, may rightly begin as something we grasp intellectually, it must in time become a matter of the heart. We have been blessed, brethren, and I've said this before, and a lot of what I'm going to say today I've said before, but I think it bears repeating, and it bears emphasizing. We have been blessed as a church in the past 100 years or in the past 50 years, depending on when you want to begin counting, to have the most comprehensive theological sound basis of knowledge and doctrine of any generation since the apostles. We are blessed with powerful knowledge from the Bible. The plan of God as defined in the holy days, it provides good answers to the salvation plan and everything in a way that other churches cannot fully comprehend and explain. And that's a very good thing. It is important. We cannot overemphasize the importance of doctrinal accuracy, because if you have heresy and misinformation, the confusion increases. So we take that as a basis. We've got the fundamentals down solid. But we can't stop there. While knowing the truth might rightly begin as something we grasp intellectually, it must in time become a matter of the heart. The whole matter boils down to a rather simple concept. The surrendered versus the rebellious heart. The entire world out there shows the results of a rebellious heart. And what makes it worse is the fact that they don't even understand and know the truth. So you have rebellious human beings going down the road to their demise, and they don't even know that they're enslaved. We, on the other hand, know the truth. It's not a lack of knowledge for the people that are sitting in this room. We're not destroyed for a lack of knowledge. For us, it's the issue of whether our heart has surrendered itself to to embrace the truth we know. The Bible refers to this as the heart of flesh versus the heart of stone, and the uncircumcised versus the circumcised heart, the stubborn versus the yielded heart. You know, we have the challenge of the difference and the disconnect between what we know in our heads and what we believe in our hearts. Perhaps nowhere in the Bible is this concept illuminated with more clarity than in the review of the events that occurred in Sinai, recorded over in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Let's go over to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 5. Beginning in verse 23, the people were afraid of God's presence. So it was when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, "Surely the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that God speaks with man, yet he still lives. Now, therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God any more, then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? You go near and hear all that the Lord our God may say, and tell us all that the Lord our God says to you, and we will hear and do it." Now, I read through that passage, and I'm going to go back and highlight some of the contradictions of what they said and what they did. Notice that God showed them his glory. He spoke out of the fire. He revealed himself to them. And they heard him. They heard him speak. And their experience was that they had heard the voice of God and survived. But, and they had heard God speak and saw that the people did not die. What a dramatic experience. What a demonstration of God's desire to be directly involved with them. You know, you have God right there on the mountain. Now, what were the results? Did they embrace him? Did they appreciate, did they marvel at the fact that there was a great God in heaven that was so interested in them that he came down and revealed himself to them? Now, here are the results. They said, "Why should we die?" Does that make any sense? It makes no sense. They had just experienced God speaking to them and did not die. And yet, what did they say? In verse 25, "Why should we die?" What they said was in a total contradiction to what they had just observed. And this is a common human phenomenon where they believe the prevailing thought of the day. They chose to believe otherwise despite the evidence to the contrary. They based their belief on the prevailing thought of the day, that humans could not survive conversing with God. And even though the evidence pointed to the contrary, they chose to believe what they believed. You can take that to the global warming discussion. Germany's leading climatologist says that the earth is no longer warming. Hasn't done it for the last 10 years. And yet we're 16 days away from signing a $10 trillion tax treaty to solve the problem that no longer is progressively getting worse. It makes no sense. I say that's a safe place to discuss a human phenomenon because, you know, it's so much more fun to talk about what the big bureaucrats in Europe and Washington are doing than to discuss what we ourselves also do. There is so much evidence. Let's take an example that I'm just picking up that is a little bit closer to home. There is so much evidence that diet, what we eat and what we drink, affects us in our physical lives directly. You know, the old adage, remember earlier I said there's a benefit to brevity? You are what you eat. You are what you eat. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? How can we be otherwise? I mean, whatever we stuff our face with is what we ultimately become. I mean, that's what the body has to work with, to manufacture ourselves. And yet, despite the overwhelming evidence to the contrary, what do? As individuals, as a society, we choose to eat things and drink things that are proven to be detrimental to our health and well-being, our bodies, which the Bible says is a temple of the living God. It's a human thing. It is a demonstration of the fact that just because we know doesn't mean that we will necessarily do. Knowing the truth is not enough. Embracing it is required. Continuing, and back to verse 26, "For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lives?" You! I mean, this is a contradiction of terms. Who has ever survived? Well, we did. But the decision that they subsequently made was based on the prevailing thought of the day that you couldn't possibly survive, so, you know, we don't want any part of this. They were scared. And when we're scared, we react in ways that defy logic. "You go," they told Moses, "you hear and we will do." You know, this promise based on fear is a contradiction in itself. We refuse to hear from God directly, but we will do what he tells you to have us do. God came and offered direct communication. He wanted to have direct relationship with them, and they pushed back. "You go see him." Now, there's a contradiction to that as well. Moses, is, from all I can tell, was just as human as the rest of them, right? So they send him to be their martyr. They were scared because they were going to die because they were human beings. So they send one human being over there to communicate with God, and then he will come back and tell us what to do. Funny how the mind works, isn't it? It doesn't resonate, brethren. It doesn't make sense. This contradiction between what we know and what we believe is a classic example of what psychology calls cognitive dissonance. I always like how psychology finds politically correct labels to make us feel so much better about our just, you know, downright bad, if I can use that word, human vices. You know, a lot of these vices now become disabilities, and you become challenged. It just makes us feel so much better. Well, here's the definition of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is a psychological phenomenon in which someone is called upon to learn something which contradicts what they already think they know. Particularly if they are committed to their prior knowledge, they are likely to resist new learning. There is a more, there's a word that can express this with more brevity. It's called stubbornness. But that somehow connotates that we're not good. So you call it cognitive dissonance. It makes me feel much better to know that I have a case of cognitive dissonance as opposed to just good old-fashioned stubbornness. See the difference? Truth is indeed a rare commodity, and yet it is truth that liberates. It is truth that sets us free. And can you see how? You know, if I recognize that I'm just being downright stubborn and change, I will benefit. But if I understand that I have a bout of cognitive dissonance, I'm less motivated to affect change. And hence, the cycle of oppression and slavery can go on. The children of Israel have been liberated from Egypt by God Himself in so many wondrous deeds and powerful miracles that it has survived the test of time. I mean, the story of the liberation from Egypt and going into the Promised Land, I have said, contains every element of human behavior. And, you know, if you want to have a lesson on how people react and how they do things, it's all there. But they had not surrendered their heart to God. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 29. Oh, that they had such a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Why is it, brethren, that God wants so much good for us and means so well? And has done so much for us, including sending His only Son to die for us, and yet, as He laments here, oh, that they had such a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Brethren, I have stated before, and I'll repeat it. I wish that, you know, some academics should probably do this at some point to demonstrate it. It is my belief that if in the United States we would consistently obey one of the last six commandments, whether that be stealing, not committing adultery, or murder, that we would be able to balance the burgeoning federal budget with the savings. You know, when you just let's talk about stealing, for example. It's a simple one. If you look at not the cost of what is stolen every year, that's not the entire cost of not keeping that commandment. You have to calculate in the cost that is incurred to attempt to prevent stealing. Think of all the lock manufacturers that would go out of business. All the lawyers that couldn't ply their trade because they didn't have to defend or prosecute thieves. You know, you just keep adding all that cost and it becomes an exorbitant amount. You see, God said that they would keep my commandments, that it might be well with them. If man would keep the Ten Commandments, the wealth that would be built is unimaginable. I mean, it's just incomprehensible. And yet, we do not have such a heart. Let's go back to the banks of the Red Sea over in Exodus chapter 14. And just notice what occurred there. Exodus chapter 14, you know, here's the Red Sea crossing. And it concludes in verse 31, "Thus Israel saw the great work of the Lord, the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed the Lord and his servant Moses." They believed, it says here. And that's something that is bandied around in the religious community. Just believe. I'm going to show you here and show us that it takes a lot more than to just believe. Notice what the reaction was when they believed the Lord and his servant Moses. It was a spontaneous and appropriate reaction. In verse 15, "Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name.'" Notice what they said they would do. They would sing to God. That is a common denominator of all churches. They sing. That's a good thing. They praise him, the Israelites said they would do. And they exalt him. You notice what is missing? What is missing is that critical element that determines whether or not we will have a stony heart or a yielded heart of flesh. What's missing here is obey. They said they would sing to him, that they would praise him, and that they would exalt him. And that's all well and good, but there's not a word here about yield, obey, or surrender. This response, while it is appropriate to sing and praise and exalt, illustrates a critical point that ultimately led to Israel's demise. They sought to accept God's truth and the resulting liberty, but refused to surrender their hearts. And that is where we are at every day, each moment in time, brethren. We make choices on whether or not we will accept God's commandments and surrender our hearts to his will. The whole concept of developing a surrendered heart lies at the heart and core of obtaining the liberty that Christ promised when he said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Without a surrendered heart, liberty will elude us no matter how much truth we commit to our heads. We will, as the Bible says, ever learn, but not come to the knowledge of the truth. There's something about immersion learning. And the beauty about God's plan is that he immerses us into what he is doing by asking us and inviting us to celebrate days throughout the year in which we can experience and become immersed in what he is doing. And really, when we fully embrace it, every day is an immersion. Every minute is an immersion as we plow through making choices on whether we will or won't submit ourselves to God. Without a surrendered heart, life won't work the way it's supposed to, because what we believe in our heart does not match what we believe in our heads. It creates a dichotomy in which we become entangled instead of being liberated, as Christ said. The epitome of that, brethren, is politics. I despise it. Because when people start playing politics, truth goes out the window. And it becomes a tangled web because you are posturing instead of being candid about the facts so that they can actually be solved. That's why I know the current reforms that are happening won't work, because it was done with political posturing. Half-truth, untruth, and just blatant lies. Bribery and corruption. It's the basis of what we've got. That's why it took 2,000 pages. It creates a mess. That's the beauty of the fact that God was able to define the right way to live into 10 concise statements called the Ten Commandments. And you can even boil that down to 2 broad principles. The 2 principles are to love your God and to love your neighbor. And then you have 4 simple statements to define the former and 6 simple statements that define the latter. It's the brevity about the whole thing that makes it beautiful. It also makes it a big challenge, because it flies right, it gets right to the heart of the matter. You know, people, human nature infused with Satan agitating, there's something about God's commandments that we just repel against. But we can take courage because Christ said, the truth shall make you free. So in the remaining time that we have today, I'd like to examine the heart of the Israelites and by extension ours, by using 4 illuminating guideposts that will show us the path that they were on and by extension we are on. These guideposts mark critical crossroads of behavioral patterns. What I want you to do is to think about, you know, traveling down a street and a road, and you come to an intersection. And we have to make a choice. Do we turn left? Do we turn right? Do we go straight ahead? Except that we're talking about behavioral crossroads, where we make a choice. Do I behave in this manner or that manner, or do I plow straight ahead? And where do these roads lead? It is like coming to a crossroad and looking at the street signs on top of the post. One sign points down the path of the surrendered heart to liberty, the other to the path of rebellion and enslavement and oppression. The right choice is simple enough. A rational mind is able to comprehend that the right choice is to take the path that leads to liberty. But our rebellious and deceptive hearts would often have us go down another path despite the consequences. Let's take a look first at the crossroad of faith and fear. We're here in Exodus chapter 14. Let's take a look at Israel. And they were at the crossroad of faith and fear. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of the land of Egypt? They were at a crossroad. I mean, it's understandable that they were afraid because Pharaoh was coming after them. But notice what the normal reaction is to fear, what the normal human reaction is to fear. They accused. And if you're afraid, you accuse. It's normal to do that. It is wrong. I mean, it is, just to make it a little bit more palatable, cognitive dissonance that somehow feels so much better than just plain human stubbornness. Or, as Jeremiah said, the heart is deceitful above all things. That would never sell in today's world. You know, how can you possibly say that your heart is deceitful? Oh my, I mean, that sounds so bad. Well, you know what? The truth is, the heart is deceitful, and it is bad for you. Continuing, is this not the word that we told you? Oh, isn't this just so human? I told you so. Where have you heard that before? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would be better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more forever. Thankfully, Moses stood strong and chose faith over fear when they were at that critical juncture, and the Red Sea opened, and they marched forward, and I would dare say that the Israelites went through the Red Sea out of sheer fear, more than faith, and that's demonstrated by their behavior later on. But one strong leader's choice to choose the road that led to faith took them down the path further towards liberty. He failed later, but it took them a step forward. Whenever we make that choice, when fear strikes, as it does daily, Moses' advice here, to stand still in that moment of fear, still is good advice. Let's go over to Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, in verse 54. Then having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, and Peter followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled the fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them, and a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, this man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. And after a little while, another saw him and said, you also are of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. Man, I'm not. And not much has changed in language over 2,000 years. Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, surely this fellow also is with him, for he is a Galilean. His accent gave him revealed who he was. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you are saying. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Then Peter went out and wept bitterly. Peter responded humanly. He chose the crossroad of fear. He was afraid to admit that Jesus Christ was his teacher. And he, out of fear, denied him three times. And he was going down a very bad road after that choice. But the important thing is, he came back. You ever notice what happens when you're out driving around? And you're driving around and you take the wrong road. Should have gone straight ahead, but you turned right. You go down the road about a mile and you realize, I'm going the wrong way. What do? You have to turn around, retrace your steps, come back to the intersection, turn right, and go straight ahead. That's what Peter did. Peter repented and changed, came back, and took the right road. That's how it works for us as well. Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5, verse 27, And when they had brought them, they set them before the council. And the high priest asked them, saying, "Did we not strictly command you not to teach in this name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us." Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." Notice the difference. Notice the powerful liberation that Peter had experienced because he now decided to make the choice of faith instead of fear. Before, you know, he crumbled at a servant girl's question. And now he's standing before the high court and unequivocally states, we ought to obey God rather than man. He came to the same crossroad and chose the right direction. Brethren, I would maintain that we come to this crossroad frequently. I would venture to say that we come to this crossroad, let's say, multiple times a day. The question is, when we are confronted with a situation and that feeling of fear overwhelms us, we need to do as Moses said, stand still and choose faith. And faith in this case involves doing what is right. What we know to be right instead of what our impulse would have us do. It's a pretty easy concept. Acting on it and doing it is much more difficult. Take a look at another crossroad. The crossroad of repent and resent. Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17, beginning in verse 1. Then all the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, why is it that you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? You know, Israel resented their circumstances and a calling that God had given them. They resented having left Egypt. I mean, it is the classic dichotomy. You've been oppressed and subjected to abject tyranny for over 400 years, and now God is promising to lead you to a land of liberty that flows with milk and honey, and they resented. They didn't want to pay the difficulties that were part of the journey. It was too hard. You know, brethren, we know the truth. We understand the Sabbath. We have accepted God's call. The question is, do we embrace it? Do we change our lives, or do we resent it? You know, we know the truth, but do we tithe, for example, with resentment? See how, you know, do we grudgingly do what God recommends? You know, God says He loves a cheerful giver. If we give because it is obligatory, and we give because we have to, instead of cheerfully giving what God requires of us, we cannot realize the full blessing of it. And this, of course, applies to, you know, we know the truth about the Sabbath, we know the truth about a lot of different things. Do we embrace it cheerfully? Do we embrace it fully? Or do we resent it? It's a crossroad. A behavioral crossroad. We keep the Sabbath, but resent how much it limits us. We do it because we know we have to. But it's kind of a limiting factor because we can't go do everything that we would otherwise do. You see that? Again, that's the tension, that's the crossroad, the choices that we have to make. We accept God's call, but resent the way He has called us to, the circumstances in which He has put us. You know, we contend with God. You're not fair. It's not fair that I'm in the situation that I'm in. Well, as Gwen Perry so eloquently told me, her mama used to say, there's two kinds of fair in this world, the state and the county. Gwen, I've quoted you on that. Did it this week again with one of my engineers. As I have a friend of mine, she had a grandma from Kentucky, two kinds of fair. And of course, when people talk about things being fair, that's always a good way for me to get myself out of it, because people realize, I mean, life just isn't fair. So we can say, we can contend with God and say, this is not fair. Well, is it or isn't it? If we follow this path, it will head out into a wilderness not more hospitable than the wilderness of sin. We will know the truth, but we will not be free. What we need to do is to repent, to change our heart, to surrender our will. It's the most difficult, most challenging thing any human being can face. Self-mastery is next to impossible. Smart people have tried it and failed. The key to it, of course, is the power of the Holy Spirit. Let's go to the next crossroad. The crossroad of marvel versus murmur. Exodus chapter 16 and verse 1. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin which is between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." The saga just keeps repeating itself. There's something about complaining and murmuring that the human nature just loves. In fact, some years ago, I went to a meeting. I actually don't remember what the meeting was. What I remember was the new concept and word that I was introduced to. It's called recreational complaining. I thought, yeah, I have to remember that, you know. That'd be good for a sermon sometime. And so today you benefit from me having going to a meeting, of which that's the only thing I still remember, was recreational complaining. You ever notice that when you're complaining, you just kind of get in the mood. And it's so much fun. It feels good. You're fully justified and you just complain. And it's recreation. It's the wrong road. But you know, it's worth it. You know, we'll take the next detour and get back to the right road. You know, instead of murmuring, there's so much to marvel about and what God does, is doing, and can do. And there's just so much to marvel about. It is so human. But it's indicative of an unsurrendered heart and attitude. It leads not to liberty or truth, but a life shackled with unhappiness. You just moan and you complain. And the funny thing is, often it is the people that complain the most are those that, if you look at the actual circumstances of their life, have much to be thankful for. And then there are people that are in just dire circumstances that are so thankful for what we have. And you go visit poor countries, that's something that it just seems there's something about human nature. The more blessings you have, we're incapable of handling them, I suppose. So we complain. Becomes recreation. It's not a very good form of recreation, but a lot of people appreciate doing it. And me being of German descent and having lived there, understand that, I mean, Germans are very good at complaining. we complain, and I'm not going to try to translate it because it won't translate. There's a really funny saying in Germany about the fact that we complain, but on a very high level. To give you an example, you know, we go to the bar, we drink big mugs of beer, and we complain about how bad life is and all the injustices and how dumb the Americans are. And, you know, you just go on and on and on how bad life is. And then you pay the bill, you get into the Mercedes and go home. It's tough. Tough life. But it's so human. I mean, you look at what the Israelites were doing. I mean, they were freed from oppression without an armed insurrection. Okay? God had delivered them. They didn't have to lift the sword. He took them through the Red Sea. I mean, all they had to do was walk through the desert for a couple weeks until they get to the Promised Land. That was all. I mean, You look at the facts and you say, you know, why didn't they get it? The same reason we don't. It's human nature. Psalms chapter 9 verse 1 says this: "I will praise you, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will tell of all your marvelous works." And brethren, I would encourage all of us to become a committee of one to tell our brethren about the marvelous works of God. I remember that coming into the church, where people would talk about the miracles God performed, and, you know, in my particular case, I had lost my job, the only job I had ever known, and they said, oh, God's going to find you a better job. I lost my job, and God gave me a better one, and I'm thinking, yeah, right. But it did plant a seed. It did plant a seed, and while I was cynical about it, the seed was there. You know, that would be nice if it would happen. You see, if we tell of all God's marvelous works, it will be good for us because it's the right choice, it's the right road. But more importantly, it will lift those up that are around us and encourage them to also look to God for positive things. Look at one last crossroad here. The crossroad of love and lust. This is a big one. One is often confused with the other. You know, the sign is turned. Can you imagine that? You know, love and lust. You turn the sign. And that was a classic trick in World War II that people did, you know, when you have invading armies, you go and you turn the signs and the signposts, and you have someone coming in a tank, and you look up to the sign to try to figure out where they're at, and they think they're going on 3rd Street, they're really going on a different street, and you do that once or twice, and things really become a mess because you don't know which road you're on. And I think that's a good way of describing, you know, love and lust. One is often confused with the other. The sign is turned. The focus is on food, sex, and money. You look at the mainstream media today, and you can't help but see that. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It is, by the way, not a new phenomenon. Verse 6. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And you know, this is in the context of the Israelites. And do not become idolaters as some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, enumerates a number of crossroads, not the least of which is the choice between lust and love. The latest Good News magazine actually is almost a treatise on creation and evolution, quoting a gentleman that has a degree in biology from the University of California at Berkeley, which is interesting that you have someone that graduated from that institution that is a prominent authority on how evolution is in trouble, because obviously they would espouse evolution. Some very good information, but there's also an article here by Don Hooser on the crucial factor in producing fruit, eradicate the weeds of sin. And there was one paragraph I wanted to quote to you. Talks about us being a garden. I didn't mark the quote I wanted. Oh, here it is. It's right in the first paragraph. If you've tried to maintain a vegetable garden, flower garden, lawn, cropland, pasture or park, you know about weeds. You didn't plant them. They just showed up. I thought that was a very concise statement that makes sense. You know, when you have a garden, you know, you till it, you work it, you plant your plant all the vegetables that you want to raise, you don't have to ever plant weeds. That is something that's instructive and also encouraging in one respect is, you know, all the thoughts and the problems that crop up in our hearts are like weeds. And if they aren't ripped out and eradicated and pulled out, they will suffocate the fruits, the vegetables that we intend to grow. But he made a very concise statement. You did not plant them. So the question is, who did? I'll let you answer that question. Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Now the mixed multitude, this is verse 4, who were among them yielded to intense craving. They were lusting. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, and the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. I wonder if they also remembered the smell. But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Now the manna was like coriander seeds, and its color like the color of bdellium. They detested what God had given them, which no doubt was a perfectly balanced, concentrated, freeze-dried superfood, manna. They wanted to have the meat, the cucumbers, the leeks, the melons, and the garlic that they enjoyed in their oppression. You know, brethren, this is, you know, one of those topics, one of those things that, you know, I go from preaching to meddling. We really need to ask ourselves when we eat and drink whether or not we are being responsible stewards of the temple of God that God has given us. You know, we imbibe in things that we shouldn't, and we eat foods that we know are not good for us, or drink sodas to the extent that we become bigger than we ought to be. I mean, the question really is that a decision where it's a behavioral decision we're making? What path is it leading on? Is it responsible? Is it responsible for us to make choices that we know are not good for us and then expect God to heal us when the ultimate consequences come to be? I mean, there are consequences to those things. You know, we've got diet soda, we've got aspartame, we've got MSG, we have countless things that are in foods that cause all kinds of problems, and they are foisted upon us. Well, just to take Coca-Cola, for example. Coke is it. And I'm just picking on that. Well, Coke's not it. It is carbonated water, a whole load of sugar, and a bunch of other things that's not good for us, that costs about a nickel to make, and the can, the last time I checked, has about 2 cents of aluminum. Are we willing to pay a buck for it? You think about it. Think about what we're doing when we do that. And I'm picking on Coke. It could be anything. But when you really think about it, you are paying a buck for something that costs someone 7 to 10 cents to make at the most, plus transportation costs. And they've taken that big margin to educate us about the fact that it is it, the good life will come from drinking Coke. The one thing that I can assure you is the good life will not come from drinking Coke. I mean, you'll get a momentary surge because of all the sugar that's loaded into it. You could get the same effect by mixing sugar into water, and it wouldn't taste quite as good, and getting that bounce. But that's a crossroad. I mean, is it loving? Is it loving to do that, or is it lust? We can talk. I mean, I said I'm going from preaching to meddling, but it is a topic we have to ask ourselves, and whether it is responsible for us to imbibe in things that have been proven. The facts are clear on many things. Studies have been done on a lot of foods and beverages on whether or not they're good for us, and then we have to make a choice. And then ask yourself, why is it that I'm drinking this stuff? Have I bought into the notion that Coke is it? Again, I said I could pick anything. Sorry to those of you that drink Coke. Well, no, I'm not sorry. You know, if the shoe fits, wear it. Coca-Cola is one of those companies that is espousing the one world government, which ultimately will come. You know how they're able to do it? They're able to do it because we're willing to pay a buck for something that costs 10 cents. And maybe I'm biased, but I mean, my margins in the manufacturing business are this. 50% of what I sell something for is material cost. And then you have to somehow out of the other 50% pay your employees and the benefits and the cost of operating, et cetera, et cetera. I'd love to have something that costs me 10 cents to make and I sell it for a buck and tell people it's it. It's called marketing. It's also called deception. The question is whether or not we buy into it. First Timothy chapter 6. First Timothy chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, back to the whole healthcare issue. Think of how much less healthcare would cost if people would live even basic healthy lifestyles. It would save billions of dollars. It's the crossroad of love versus lust. We lust after things that are not good for us. Instead of making a choice to love our neighbor as ourselves, because if we make bad choices and have to be put up in hospital and have to have all this work done us to try to mitigate the consequences of our choices, it costs a lot of money. First Timothy chapter 6 in verse 9, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Never has that rang truer than in the last couple of years. A friend of mine in Pittsburgh that runs a very fine, small tool and die shop. Well, it depends what you call small. They have 90 tool and die makers, so they're not real small for a tool shop. Told me this a couple of years ago when we were discussing all the outsourcing and all the things that were going on in connection to, we're getting to the point where not only can't we make it here, we have nobody that knows how to make it. And he put it with clarity and brevity. He said, John, greed is going to be our undoing. And it has been. Greed has been our undoing. The love of money. It's not money that's the problem. It's the love of it that is the problem. Sex, food, and money are powerful urges that need to be controlled. Brethren, as the struggle for truth and liberty and the quest for tyranny and dominion continue down a collision course on the world scene, we need to be reminded that we must take a different path. When we come to these behavioral crossroads, it is time to pause and to make the right choice. It takes courage, but it should be encouraging that Jesus Christ has promised that not only can we know the truth, but if we embrace it, it shall set us free. Christ's words say that true liberty not only can, but most assuredly we will be achieved in our lives. Jesus Christ said, "You shall know the truth." And to the extent we embrace it, it shall set us free. Have a good Sabbath.